Hello, and welcome to the Honest Politics Podcast. My name's Alex Gamsik, and I am the founder of Honest Politics, LLC. My company does high-level political consulting, but not for politicians. My services are catered to everyday Americans, just like you and me. So let's get started. And today, I was going to do the gun policy podcast as promised, but with all the research that I've done, it's taking a while, and I'm going to need to edit that episode heavily. So I'm going to do a mostly unedited episode again, reading off one of my prior papers. This one was from a presidential history class, so it should be a little more entertaining and maybe a little less substantive, but let's see. So I had to answer three questions, and the first question was, the period since 1980 has witnessed a significant rise in conservative control over government in the United States. Explain the major reasons for the rise of conservatism during the past generation. Be sure to consider in your answer the role of the presidential elections from 1980 to 2000 and the Congressional Revolution of 94. So my response. From the landslide election of Ronald Reagan to Barack Obama's 2008 victory, political momentum has remained on the side of the conservatives. Obama's rebuttal of conservatism did not last, as the Congress quickly began reverting to conservatism during the 2010 midterms. This conservative era was completely unlike what had occurred from FDR to Nixon, where government programs signaled success, signaled progress, and conservatives simply maintained status quo. Recently, conservatism has come to mean opposition to the federal government and repealing some of its major programs, beginning with public opposition to the Vietnam War. Combined with Nixon's resignation, Americans have been losing faith in the federal government's ability to fix the country's problems through new programs, resulting in an anti-government sentiment that has persisted from the late 1970s to the current administration. It is because conservatives advocate for reducing the role of government that Americans have voted them into power across the country. The election of Donald Trump, the first presidential candidate without government experience since Wendell Willkie, shows just how anti-establishment this country has become. I should also say that this was written in November/December of 2016. And the perceived failures of Carter, Clinton, and Bush presidencies have reinforced this notion that the federal government is ineffective. As a result, conservatives will continue to dominate this country's politics until faith is restored in the federal government once again. The period of 1932 through 1972 was a period of relative liberalism, with presidents who have either added government programs or kept the major ones intact. FDR's New Deal programs, like the Public Works Administration, Civilians Conservation Corps, and Works Progress Administration, expanded the government's responsibilities, employing people suffering under the Great Depression. Long-term results, such as the Social Security Act, minimum wage, and child labor laws, ensured that the American government would become a liberal welfare state. Truman attempted to expand these programs even further through Fair Deal legislation that included an expansion of health care. Eisenhower came to power as the first Republican president in 20 years, yet he did not attempt to meddle with the liberal welfare state. Instead, he bolstered the federal government's authority by sending troops to enforce federal law in Little Rock when schools were not integrating racially. Eisenhower's moderate republicanism could hardly be called conservative by today's standards. With John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson's elections, liberal progress was given a green light to continue. Finishing the work that Kennedy started, Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security adjustments. This great society was followed by Nixon, who was markedly more conservative than those mentioned above. Still, Nixon was a pragmatist, not an idealist. He was wise enough to oversee the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency, to limit pollution and price controls to limit inflation. Both would be seen as liberal actions unacceptable in today's conservative movement. As Nixon's presidency ended via the Watergate scandal, Americans' perception of the office changed. Trust had been eroding throughout the Vietnam War, which Americans were beginning to realize was not worth the cost. As the body count increased, protests across the country did as well. Nixon helped to end the war, but American trust was still low when the Watergate scandal broke 42 years ago. This broke American faith in the nation's highest office beyond repair. The federal government was mistrusted and the glory of the presidency had diminished. By rejecting Gerald Ford's re-election in 1976, Americans were choosing to rebuke whatever government was in power, rather than elect a Democrat with plans at government expansion. Jimmy Carter's presidency was for a Democrat. He ran against President Ford as an outsider, having been a little-known governor and peanut farmer in Georgia. He passed conservative agenda items like deregulation of trucking and airline industries. Unfortunately for him, the American embassy in Iran was taken over and over 50 hostages were trapped. Carter's resulting diplomacy and botched military rescue did not resolve the crisis. The economy suffered under stagflation, with huge lines at gas stations. Americans were very unhappy with Carter's performance. As a result, the president issued the famous malaise speech, which angered Americans who thought the blame was unnecessarily forced on their shoulders. Americans were seeking confidence in the federal government once again, and President Carter failed in that respect. Looking for a new hope, Americans voted in the ultimate outsider, Ronald Reagan. Reagan's landslide win came at a time when Americans are seeking a new course for America. Rather than looking for the government for solutions, rather than looking to the government for solutions, Reagan gave people a new option by deferring to the private sector. The economic theories of Laffer overcame the economic theories of Keynes. By slashing regulations and taxes, Reagan completely reformed the Republican Party and what it meant to be a conservative. Republicans mistrusted the government and sought leaders who would dismantle its programs. Democrats still clung to the rationale of FDR, who wanted the government to help those who could not help themselves. Although the government's budget expanded under Reagan, resulting in a higher debt-to-GDP ratio, he was able to maintain the appearance of a conservative reformer. After the failures of Vietnam, Watergate, stagflation, and Iran, Reagan's presidency was scandal-free for 7 years, until the Iran-Contra scandal. By then, Reagan conservatism was the new normal for American politics. It would be up to Democrats to actively work against the new normal. As a result, Democrats did not attain the presidency for 12 years, and they only did so because Ross Perot's third-party campaign disrupted Bush's re-election. It was Perot's campaign that was the sixth and final key to the White House lost by President Bush. By keys, I'm referring to Professor Lichtman's keys to the White House, and Professor Lichtman was my professor for this class. Back to the paper. Perot's campaign gained 19% of the popular vote by running an outsider's race. He was a billionaire with no government experience who simply attacked the administration without much in the way of substance. Most Americans were still old enough to harbor anti-government resentment from the Nixon and Carter years. They therefore split their votes, allowing Bill Clinton to win the lowest popular vote percentage since Woodrow Wilson, and he was the president during World War I. I just put that part in. Bill Clinton was certainly an outsider candidate compared to Bush, and Americans were therefore willing to give the new Democrat a chance in 1992. But after Hillary Clinton's failed health care initiative, which critics lamented for being over 1,000 pages long, in controversy over Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Congress flipped to the Republicans by large margins. The anti-government sentiment was fully alive and well, as Republicans promised to halt Clinton's government initiatives. Sorry for the typo. As Clinton's second term became defined by the Lewinsky scandal, Americans once again had a reason to mistrust the government. Americans too young to remember the Nixon and Carter years now had a reason to renounce faith in the federal government. Coming out of a scandal-ridden administration, Vice President Gore lost the 2000 race to someone with less government experience who planned to cut taxes and limit the scope of government. George W. Bush was the son of former President Bush and the governor of a large state, but he was more anti-establishment than Gore. Gore came fresh out of Clinton's administration, and Bush was a throwback to the days of Reagan, broke away from the scandalous administrations of the past. During the campaign, It did not matter that the economy was doing well, that foreign policy was marked by victories, or that the budget had been balanced for the first time in decades. What mattered was that the anti-government rejection of Clinton aligned best with conservatism, and Americans wanted to elect a redeemer like Reagan. Just as Reagan's election had changed American politics, 2001 had changed the American way of life. After the Twin Towers fell, Bush's approval rating skyrocketed, and support for the two preceding wars unified most Americans. John Kerry had no way of defeating Bush after tragedy had rallied Americans around their current president. Taking a risk, Kerry campaigned as a war hero. He was hoping to ride a wave of patriotism into the White House. It proved ineffective after doubters cast unfair skepticism on Kerry's war record. Bush won in 2004 because the threat of terrorism finally drew American eyes toward the established government for help. Americans were scared of future attacks, and only the federal government was powerful enough to prevent them. Bush betrayed that trust with his handling of Hurricane Katrina, the economy, and Iraq. After the hurricane, there were accusations of racism against Bush due to the underwhelming FEMA response. Bush blamed this on local governments, but did not escape widespread criticism. When the housing bubble crashed the economy, Bush was slow to enact any Keynesian spending measures that may have saved it. American opposition to the Iraq War grew as soldiers continued to die, and Iraq was no closer to real democracy. Mistrust was brewing once again with the American people, and it would take another reformer to restore faith in the White House. In 2008, Barack Obama and the Democrats were seen as outsiders ready to redirect the country. Obama won in 2008 because of a backlash against President Bush, and finally, a backlash against Republican conservatism. The House, Senate, and presidency returned to Democratic control for the first time since 1992, giving the Democrats a chance to prove that they were different. However, Obama's large-scale stimulus plan and complex health care law exemplified the Washington establishment. These measures, in conjunction with his desires to combat climate change, shut down Guantanamo Bay, and establish equal rights for all people, made many Americans uncomfortable with the change that was occurring. The resulting anti-establishment movement turned against Obama's programs with the rise of the Tea Party in 2010. Conservatism began creeping back to power and culminated with the election of Donald Trump in 2016. Trump is already failing to bring some of his campaign promises to fruition, and is likely to result in yet another anti-government backlash. Such a rejection of the presidency is characteristic of the period following Nixon's resignation and Carter's administration. From FDR through Nixon, federal government was the source of social progress for helping the underprivileged. It produced technological marvels like the mission that brought Americans to the moon. After the Watergate resignation and Carter's shortcomings, Reagan's revolution reset government responsibility. With the phrase, government is not the solution to our problem, government is the problem. That sentiment has not dissipated from public life. It is the reason limited government conservatives have dominated this generation's politics. The presidency will not be restored to its glory until faith is restored in the federal government. A future president needs to unite his/her constituents like never before. When that happens, the progressive Democrats may become the norm for American public life. And now, if it works, I will put in a quick ad break. Be right back. And we're back. I'm going to use the second question's answer for this last segment. I'm going to ignore the third one because I tried to argue that Michelle Obama would be the best Democratic nominee, and it was just kind of a stupid answer to the question, so we're going to forget it. So this question. Southern politics have undergone significant changes from the 1930s to the present. Describe the major elements of these changes and their impact on the American presidential elections. All right, so American politics have changed significantly since the 1930s. Southern politics have been uprooted from their democratic beginnings. This shift, and democratic is uppercase, you know, like the party, not the democracy authoritarian spectrum. Okay. So the shift of Republican dominance in the South started with Barry Goldwater's 1964 campaign, which flipped the Deep South red for the first time since South Carolina and Louisiana voted for Rutherford B. Hayes in 1976. So just a quick break. 1964 is the first time the Deep South went red since almost 100 years. So for almost 100 years, from 1876 to 1964, the Deep South was Democrat. The entire southern region of east of The entire southern region east of Texas is now solidly Republican. Save for the swing states of Florida, Virginia, and North Carolina. The Democratic Party is no longer competitive in most of the Deep South, both in presidential and local elections. This occurred because politicians like President Reagan took advantage of the South's history of discrimination and Christian values in order to lock in those states for the Republican Party. After the Civil War, Democrats opposed Republican Reconstruction and rights for former slaves. Slaves had been banned by the 13th Amendment, but the system of sharecropping kept former slaves trapped in a cycle of poverty. Furthermore, segregation remained a normal part of life in the South. As the Republican North moved toward a more integrated society, Southern Democrats remained in their discriminatory customs. This continued throughout the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt. FDR wanted to rid the South of its Jim Crow policies, but needed Southern states in his coalition to pass broad new welfare programs. By compromising advances on civil rights, Roosevelt secured the Southern vote for Democrats during his four terms in office. Working-class Southerners of all races benefited from his policies that strengthened unions, established a minimum wage, and other labor laws. It was not until race reemerged as an issue that the South finally became Republican. This occurred during the campaign between Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater in 1964. Goldwater was the only Republican, along with six Southern Democrats, who had voted against the Civil Rights Act. That's a nice record for you, I guess. Civil rights were hotly debated on the campaign trail, and Southern whites noticed. Many voted for the Republican Barry Goldwater in order to preserve their racist Jim Crow policies. These voters were so dedicated, they would walk through walls for their former candidate. So that's a phrase Professor Lichtman liked to use. Such an attachment did not fade easily, and these states did not vote for a Democrat again until Jimmy Carter's election. During the election of 1968, anti-establishment candidate George Wallace won most of the Deep South as a segregationist. Southern voters rejected the establishment candidates Nixon and Humphrey, because neither wanted to reinstall Jim Crow laws. After the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act started to take real effect, white Southerners had come to terms with their loss on civil rights issues. No major party's presidential candidate would call for a repeal of these laws after George Wallace. Even so, the Republican Party maintained policies that appealed to white Southerners. This Southern strategy meant ignoring the black vote in the South and responding instead to what white Southerners wanted. Republicans adopted a platform that appealed to hardline Protestant Christians, disregarding the more secular Northerners. After the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1976, Republicans used the abortion issue to maintain a solid hold on these Southern Christians. As such, a polarizing topic worked well because it did not need much technical knowledge to base an opinion off of one way or the other. In Chris Matthews' Tip in the Gipper, Southerners were described as conservatives at heart. It just took Reagan and the Southern strategy to coax that conservative out of them. The band of Southern Democrats that emerged from the era of Goldwater were, in some ways, equivalent to modern-day Republicans. They voted with Republicans on many issues, and Reagan was able to count on them for support in passing his legislation. Speaker Tip O'Neill knew he could not corral these Southern Democrats into his caucus, and instead worked with Reagan directly to try and meet him in the middle. The partisanship of these two men persisted even though they had great differences between each other. Their strategy of heavy political maneuvering in the daytime, followed by palling around after 6 o'clock, paid off in progress for the country. In part of Matthew's book, Reagan was described as a caring person when it came to helping an individual with their problem, but was generally uncaring when he learned of an entire group that was suffering. Such a double standard persists with the Republican Donald Trump today, who seemed indifferent to Muslim persecution in America, but lamented with the family of someone killed by an illegal immigrant. This strategy works in the South, which had a history of ignoring the damage that segregation did to an entire group of people by saying that individual facilities were made equally. Reagan was a master of another double standard, promoting his non-existent Christian values as an example for the country. He was the great communicator because he was able to get his ideas across to the American people in a language everyone could understand. His promotion of family values culminated in his farewell address, which read, "All great change in America begins at the dinner table." It was his desires for family values and traditional familial roles that helped prevent the Equal Rights Amendment from passing in the late 1970s. This amendment would have given equal rights to men and women, but a movement of conservative women led by Phyllis Schlafly stopped it from ratification by 3/4 of the states. Schlafly was concerned that housewives would be worse off under the new amendment and argued that not every woman wanted a job away from their children. The desire to preserve traditional roles for women also connected to the Protestant nature of Southerners at the time. Those Protestants tended to use selective passages from Scripture to uphold their family values argument against rights for women. Such arguments may have sounded powerful, but conservatives had a mixed record when it came to actually upholding these Christian Southern values. Ronald Reagan, hero of American conservatism, was a terrible husband. He cheated on his wife many times and had been previously divorced in part due to his promiscuous behavior. Donald Trump was divorced twice and was recorded as saying that he tried to move on a married woman. Conservative policies against abortion and equal pay for women may benefit some people, but do a great deal of harm to other women. The idea that Christian values can dictate one's policy helped Reagan and the other Republicans keep a firm hold on the South after civil rights was a done deal. The primary target of discrimination shifted, and Christian values were used to repress the rights of homosexuals. LGBT people were still campaigning for their rights through anti-discrimination laws today. The Bible explicitly condemns homosexuality, which many Southerners used as justification for their opposition to gay marriage. By taking a stand against LGBT people, that continues in the party platform to this day, Republicans doubled down on the Southern strategy. They ignored the votes of minorities and focused on the majority of the Southern Christian population that opposed LGBT rights. The Southern strategy faltered slightly in the 90s, when Bill Clinton won a few deep Southern states. This was mostly due to Ross Perot's third-party campaign, which gained 19% of the national popular vote in 1992, and 8% in 1996. All three candidates in the elections were from the South. Although the Deep South? What did I try to write there? And likely split the Southern vote three ways? I don't know what I was trying to say. The anti-establishment Perot was particularly effective in taking away votes from H.W. Bush in 92. However, the congressional elections of 94 proved how persistent the Southern coalition was. In opposition to Clinton's policies, Southern Republicans helped to stall the progress and lead to a government shutdown in 95. George W. Bush, a Texan, won the presidency after Clinton's two terms with help from the same Southern tactics as his predecessors. He ran on his faith, and as president, vetoed funding for stem cell research based on that same faith. The two Republican candidates after him failed to win the presidency. Neither McCain nor Romney spoke about their faith as much as Bush did, which may have cost them the Protestant vote in states like Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. Donald Trump also avoided speaking about faith during his campaign, but he was able to win Northern Democratic states as well as the South. Trump also had elements of the traditional Southern strategy by campaigning on the promise of law and order in the wake of Black Lives Matter protests. Nixon used the same law and order strategy against racial uprisings in the 60s and 70s. White Southerners have a history of opposing rights for minorities, and that opposition is an unofficial element of the Republican Party to this day. It would not be fair to label all Republicans or white Southerners as racists, but the South has an undeniable history of racism that undoubtedly affected their policy decisions. Hate crimes against minorities spiked in the wake of Donald Trump's Republican victory, and hate groups like the KKK and National Policy Institute have celebrated his triumph. Many Republicans and Trump supporters reside outside the Deep South, but Republicans have a firm grasp on Southern politics, unlike any other region in the country. That is because they continue to embrace white Southern Christian values. Future Republican candidates will undoubtedly continue to manipulate these views in order to gain power, whether they believe in them or not. And I realize this was a biased-sounding essay that I wrote, and a lot of it was based on what we learned in class, and in order to get a good grade, I did get an A on this. I kind of mirrored a lot of what our professor was saying, and if you've seen Professor Lichtman on the news or follow his social media, you know he's the liberal, and this is something I've wanted to address. A lot of history, a lot of the research, academia, a lot of it is counter to what the Democrats think, but much more of it aligns with the Democratic Party platform. So when I use research and academia as a foundation for my knowledge on public policy, it's gonna sound liberal because liberals take more from academia and established norms than, say, Republicans, especially in an age of Donald Trump where windmills are said to cause cancer and climate change doesn't exist and things like that. So I hope you didn't take this bias too seriously in the fact that I wrote this as an individual. I did not write this as Honest Politics LLC, which caters its services to all Americans as long as it fits the non-discriminatory, non-violent, and completely legal limitations that I set up. But if you want to be a client, you'll hear more about that when I talk to you and we have an individual consultation. It might sound intimidating, but it's not. I really hope you call me or email me and we can set up a time for me to do some political research for you, write a speech for you, like anything a political consultant would do, I'm here to help you with. That's what Honest Politics LLC is all about. So thank you for listening to this week's episode, and I hope you tune in next week as we continue to discover the stories behind the statistics. Yeah, there's wind chimes in my house. It's hard to get a good recording without all the noise. The noise that surrounds us every day. Ooh.